We're in Consumer Affairs Committee, and committee, we're going to deviate a little ways from the posted schedule, and we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2578. Janet, can you get us up to speed, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2578 was introduced by this committee at the request of the Credit Union Association of Oregon. It makes a number of changes to credit union law to update the statutes and to provide additional consistency with some of the banking statutes. It allows credit unions, like banks, to have mobile facilities. It adds some confidentiality status to the statutes, and these are consistent with some of the banking code. The bill's changes to voting requirements are intended to make voting more convenient in order to increase participation of credit union membership. The changes to investment limits also bring some parity with banks, and reserve account changes provide parity with federal credit unions. There is a repealed section in House Bill 2578. Such disclosure of terms, changes in terms, is already required in federal regulation of credit unions, so that provision was thought to be unnecessary in the state statute. And, Mr. Chair, there is a dash one amendment. You should have received it in your packet. Let us know if you need a copy. It specifies that the mobile credit union facilities may operate only within, quote, a well-defined local community, neighborhood, or rural district that is served by the credit union. That's what I have, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Pam, I'd be a little nervous to be a depositor in any facilities on wheels.
Mr. Chair, we will go over that with you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. I'm here today with Hal Scoggins, who's the retained counsel for the Credit Union Association of Oregon. House Bill 2578 is a bill comprised of many different changes to the Oregon Credit Union Act. This is a product of discussions from our State Issues Committee and our Government Affairs Committee. Every 2 years we go through the Credit Union Act looking for updates to help make help serve our members better. I have provided you packets that will have information not only with both of our testimony, but just a general summary of the bill. This bill we also worked on with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and I know no opposition to the bill. There is a dash one amendment that was proposed by the Oregon Bankers Association, and we have accepted the amendment, and we will go through that with you. I see you have a very long schedule today, and we will be brief. I did provide you with some general background on the not-for-profit credit union structure. I've been in this committee before and heard some questions about the credit union structure, and so within my testimony on the left-hand side, there is some background on the credit union structure if you're interested in that. So I'll let Hal Scoggins start on going over the bill.
Morning, Hal.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney with Farley Witt, and we are the outside counsel for the Credit Union Association of Oregon. We also represent numerous individual credit unions throughout the states of Oregon and Washington. And I will not attempt to go through the whole bill section by section, but knowing your schedule today, I will try and be brief and answer any questions that you have. I'd like to talk about three sections of the bill, or three things that the bill does that really illustrate the nature of what this bill is. We see this as a series of technical amendments which are designed to address issues which come up from time to time where we have questions about what's interpreting what's currently in the Credit Union Act, or where we see something can be tweaked or improved. And in two of these three cases, it's actually things that are already in the Bank Act, but in keeping with the way we've looked at other things over the years, we've tried to move them into the Credit Union Act to have our own specific provisions in the Credit Union Act that deal with just with credit unions as opposed to credit unions and banks and other financial institutions. The first provision is the one that is also the subject of the Dash 1 amendments, and that's the provision on mobile facilities. And Chair Brown, you actually, as part of this amendment, would not involve putting money in, because part of the definition of mobile facility that doesn't require approval is one that involves doing anything other than taking deposits. So these would generally be facilities that wouldn't require branch approval, that is ordinarily required to locate a new brick and mortar branch, where a credit union might have a need to serve a temporary need in a particular area, say at a county fair or something like that, and they want to set up an ATM-like machine or a kiosk where members can get cash or check their balance or make transfers or have other communications with the credit union, but it's actually not a deposit-taking facility. So that's part of the definition of what a mobile facility is. And the banks have a specific provision in the Bank Act that says they can do this and when they have to get approval as if it were a branch and when they don't. We've had some questions come up from credit unions about this. And since there was no specific section on this in the Credit Union Act, we thought it was a good idea to add this to the Credit Union Act. And the folks over at the Department of Consumer and Business Services that regulate credit unions also thought that was a good idea, so here it is. The OBA was concerned about the issue of whether community credit unions especially could use these mobile facilities to expand their fields of membership, and so they've requested that we limit it so that community credit unions can only locate these facilities or carry them to areas that are within their specific geographic field of membership areas, and we're happy to include that amendment to add that limitation. So that's the first section that I want to talk about on mobile facilities. The next section is on the confidentiality of records that credit unions provide to the Department of Consumer and Business Services in the course of examinations and routine communications. We've had some people ask in our office about that. Well, you know, there's a provision in federal law that governs confidentiality of records that are given to the federal regulators. Where's the Oregon provision on this? And the answer for credit unions is, well, there's one in the Bank Act, and we can look to that one in the Bank Act, and technically it does cover credit unions, but a lot of people just simply don't think to look in the Bank Act when they're looking at statutes that govern credit unions. And so again, we've taken the provision in the Bank Act from ORS 706.720. We have revised the language somewhat to address the fact that, you know, banks have stockholders, credit unions don't, so we need to take out that provision. And then with that change, we've moved it over to the Credit Union Act so that credit unions, again, have their own specific provision to look to on confidentiality of examination reports and other records that are provided to the department. Then the third section that I'd like to talk about is one on changing the reserve requirements and transfers to the credit union's reserve accounts. We currently have provisions in the Oregon Credit Union Act, ORS 723.631 and 636 are being amended by sections 10 and 11 of this bill. And what we have is a situation where all credit unions in Oregon, whether they're federal or state, are insured by the National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund. And so they're subject to federal regulations on net worth requirements and making transfers to their regular reserve accounts when their net worth falls below certain levels, and specifically when it falls below 6%. Well, the Oregon Credit Union Act has a similar requirement in it, but the way the Oregon Credit Union Act measures the reserve requirement and specifies the transfers that credit unions have to make when they fall below that requirement is different from the way the federal transfer requirements and measurements are made. And the current Oregon language says that credit unions have to make transfers when their reserves fall below 6% of, quote, risk assets, as it's defined in the National Credit Union Administration regulations. Well, unfortunately, National Credit Union Administration has moved to different measurements and different definitions. That term isn't even defined in those regulations anymore. And when credit unions fall below that measurement, according to the Oregon Act, as it's currently written, they're supposed to make transfers to their regular reserves that equal 5% of their gross earnings. Well, the way that the NCOA regulations read is when your net worth falls below 6% of your assets, not your risk assets, then you have to make transfers equal to 0.1% of your assets until your reserves are brought back up. I know that's a little arcane, but the bottom line is we have a bunch of chief financial officers at credit unions who, when they do their monthly and quarterly reports to the regulators, they have to do calculations under these two differing sets of requirements, figure out which one requires them to make the most transfers, if any, and then do these two different sets of reports to the regulators. And we believe, and the folks at the Department of Consumer and Business Services were in agreement, that at this time there's no particular need to have credit unions go through those duplicate calculations and go through the extra paperwork that's required. And so what we've done is we've proposed a change where credit unions can simply look to the federal requirements and make those transfers and those measurements as necessary. If the Department of Consumer and Business Services determines that stricter requirements are necessary, then this change would authorize them to issue regulations that would require Oregon credit unions to go ahead and do those different calculations and adhere to the stricter requirements. But as of this time, DCBS doesn't believe it's necessary, and so this will relieve us from some of the administrative burden. That's all I have. I just wanted to give you a brief overview, again, of the idea that this really is what we consider some fairly non-controversial technical amendments to the Credit Union Act, and I thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Hals. Any questions? Janet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the confidentiality portion, did you say that the Oregon banking statute does currently apply to you, to credit unions?
Yeah, you have to get there through a convoluted series of analyses of two different statutes, but I think that we can say that the current provision in the Bank Act does cover credit unions. I won't say that it's crystal clear, but I think that we can say that. Okay. This makes it absolutely clear and puts it in the Credit Union Act where we believe it belongs.
So that makes it less of a it's not really a substantive change in terms of what the practice has been.
That is correct.
Any other questions? Can you tell me, what's the upper limit on their deposit insurance? Is it $100,000 like FDIC?
It is $100,000, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It is $100,000 like the FDIC, although, as you may know, that's based on the types of account ownership, and if you have joint accounts with other people, if you have accounts that have what we call pay-on-death beneficiaries, you can actually wind up with several hundred thousand dollars worth of insurance, not just the $100,000, again, just like the FDIC.
Thank you. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, folks. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on House Bill 2578? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2578 and open the work session on House Bill 2578. And we have some dash one amendments.
You want to adopt the dash one, I'll do it.
Okay, Representative Escobel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the dash one amendments to 2578.
Representative Escobel moves we move the dash one amendments to 2578. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, adopted. Representative Escobar.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move that we move 2578 with the dash one amendment to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Escobar moves House Bill 2578 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative Escobar.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative
Shields. Aye.
Representative
Shields.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. but is there someone that's volunteering to carry the bill on the floor and explain it?
I'll carry it.
Representative Esquivel will carry the bill for us. And committee, I just received an announcement that there will be a Republican caucus at 9:30. And so at that time, we will adjourn the bill, the committee, wherever we're at. And so there's some bills may not get the opportunity to be heard today. And with that, I'm going to, where's my schedule?
I love caucus.
Open the work session on House Bill 2392. Can you catch us up to speed? John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2392 was heard in February, and it would require the Department of State Police by January 1st, 2011, to set a base pay amount for troopers that's equal to or greater than the average base pay for city police officers of the state's five largest cities, which were listed in the bill: Portland, Salem, Eugene, Gresham, and Beaverton. And it specifies that the base pay must reflect years of service and other items listed in the bill. Mr. Chair, there's a dash one amendment. There was some discussion of whether those cities were the five largest, and the amendment, instead of listing those cities, says the five most populous cities in the state. The bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Mr. Chair, the idea was that the competition for state police is generally with cities, not with other states, and it's typical that the Department of Administrative Services, in negotiations about the police pay and budget, police salaries, looks at the surrounding states. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, are you ready to entertain a motion on this, since we've all heard this and it's pretty clear the amendments that have been brought forward address the concerns that were...
Certainly. These are known as the Kitts amendments.
They are. Beaverton is not one of the five largest. Hillsborough is.
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash ones gleefully into House Bill 2392.
Representative Kitts moves dash one amendments to 2392. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? They're adopted.
Mr. Chair, realizing that there's a Ways and Means referral, does the chairman wish to have a due pass recommendation or no recommendation?
It's your pleasure. A due pass, I would, I would favor a due pass.
Representative Yeoman, seems to.
I don't favor a due pass recommendation.
my two chairs. I'll postpone it to a date certain. I don't care.
The chair would entertain the motion.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2392 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2392 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any...
recommendation?
No recommendation, was there?
Without recommendation.
I would just move it to Ways and Means at this time. Let Ways and Means work it out in their committee as the co-chair of Ways and Means sees fit.
Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we call
Representative Walden. I was just curious why we wouldn't move this with a due pass recommendation.
Because I ask him not to.
Has he got a good reason?
Yeah. Representative Shockley.
I'll be voting for the motion, but I will be encouraging our good people at Ways and Means to pass this through their committee.
Thank you, Representative. Any other comments?
That's enough for me. You start making motions in this committee and pulling your weight in.
If they get a word in, Mr. Chair, I would.
Katie, will you call the
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Chaffler.
Aye.
Representative Steele.
Aye.
Representative
Askew. Excuse. Aye. Motion carries.
Starting argument.
Open a public hearing on House Bill 2740. Uh-oh. Excuse me. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2740 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2383. Representative Nelson.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Good morning, Donna.
Good morning. Janet, will you go ahead and give us a summation of the bill?
Thank you,
please.
Mr. Chair. This bill also has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Good morning, Representative Nelson.
Good morning, Janet.
The bill would create a task force to evaluate competitive sourcing, and it specifies that it's a 15-member task force, including legislators with particular backgrounds appointed by the Speaker of the House, President of the Senate, and additional members appointed by the Governor. It directs the task force to evaluate providing state services through contracts with public or private contractors. It specifies that committee would be staffed by the legislature, requires the task force to report to committees both on October 1st, 2006 and October 1st, 2008, and sunsets the task force in 2010. There's additional information in the background, and again, it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Good morning, Representative.
Good morning, Chair Brown. Good Chair and members of this distinguished committee, first I thank you for your service to the people of Oregon. And secondly, I thank you for the opportunity to appear before you with my take-home bill. You're receiving two very important pieces of information. One, with all of these, with the men and women attempting to win a race called Exposing the Myths and Realities of Competing Sourcing by Jeffrey Siegel. And the other one is Competitive Sourcing, Conducting Public-Private Competition in a Reasoned and Responsible Manner. And this is from the Executive Office of the President, the Office of Management and Budget. Over the years I've served in the legislature, we have continuously struggled with what we don't know. They always say you can do something about what you know, it's what you don't know that usually gets you. And the more we know, the more successful we can be approving a budget that in reality is in the best interest of all our citizens in the state. Over my many years in business, where I spent most of my life in 178 countries overseeing numerous contracts with governing agencies for Evergreen International Aviation for 24 years, and also my time as a liaison in government contracting in Washington, D.C., I continuously was amazed at the method by which we perform various services in the private enterprise compared to those provided by government entities. I'm proud to tell you that competitive bidding is very important. Our company continues to operate the most successful program in the history of the United Nations and the World Health Organizations, fighting on chersichiasis in 13 nations in Western Africa. This project has proved to me that it is very important that we have private and public competition for various programs. In the many peacekeeping missions that we conducted around the world, there were various times that governments of various countries attempted to provide services, and often it was us and other aviation operators who stepped in to cure the problems because the government was not close to the consumer, to the client, and did not fully realize what was expected, most pertinently to the safety of air operations. Over my many years as Senior Vice President of Administration and on the Board of Evergreen International Aviation's worldwide bases, I continuously focused on the six E's. I call them efficiency, effectiveness, economy, employee productivity, excellence, and enthusiasm. And that's what I think we owe our people when we look at government program contracting. It's the total management by measurement of the six M's. That's the management of the project, the money being spent, the men and women operating the project, the material, the machines used, and meeting the market's needs. So I'm here today to say that this is a very good bill. It's long overdue, and I'm hoping that you'll work with me to pass this bill so that we, in all truth and due diligence, will know that when what we're approving in our budgetary process is the actual factual contractual need being met. The actual factual contractual method of meeting the need. If you'll just briefly go over this paper, begin with page one on exposing the myths and realities of competitive sourcing, I realize that you are already familiar with it, but briefly, upon entering office, President Bush embarked on an aggressive reform of the federal government. The president's management agenda identified five pillars to bring more efficiency and effectiveness to the federal government. One pillar, competitive sourcing, has been more controversial than the others. Fearing competition for their jobs, public employees and their unions have launched an all-out assault on competitive sourcing. Yet, many of the attacks, critiques, and statements by opponents have not been accurate. Typically, they misinform and continually mischaracterize competitive sourcing. I'd like to just quickly review with you six of the most inaccurate myths circulating about competitive sourcing, and perhaps we can debunk them. Myth one is that competition through competitive sourcing is a privatization scheme. The reality is that competitive sourcing is a process to determine the most efficient, there's one of those E's, and effective, there's another, source for providing services. Government employees, and there's the third E for employee productivity, do participate in the process and often win many of the competitions. In addition, the government maintains control and oversight of operations. It's a clear, standardized, and managed process for comparing the costs and performance of work currently done by government employees against alternatives available in private and nonprofit organizations. By applying this process to commercial activities readily available in the open market, this initiative can generate cost savings and quality improvements while redirecting scarce taxpayer resources to the core mission of government. Regardless of who wins, the competition sets a higher bar, making government root out its inefficient and ineffective practices. This working leaner results in service improvements and savings. Decisions to move forward with a competition are founded purely in good management principles that date back to the Eisenhower administration. As good Senator Morris and Senator Johnson would say, we call this part of the best business practices. When competition occurs, the taxpayer ultimately wins every time. That means that our banker will continue to bank us because we've been appropriately doing our due diligence. Myth number two, competitive sourcing leads to less accountability and transparency. The reality is competitive sourcing not only increases accountability of the private bidder, but also the government employees. Competitive sourcing is about holding the winner of competitions accountable for delivering on cost and performance in government. Competition brings two very important tools to the table. First, increased transparency. For example, the bids spell out what and how the work will be completed, which is common in the private sector but virtually absent in government. There are clear and accountable guidelines for determining when and how work will be contracted out. Secondly, contracts provide mechanisms to define and demand performance. Whether a competition is won by government employees or a non-governmental vendor, competitive sourcing requires agencies to hold employees accountable or to recompete for the activity. Without competition, government agencies have no need to review their practices in the name of greater efficiency and effectiveness. They have nothing to lose. In addition, there are always reporting requirements with contracts as well as constant performing monitoring. There can be no management without measurement. Myth number three, competitive sourcing does not save money. Reality, competition has continuously been shown to save money. Recently, and I brought you their report, the competitive sourcing from the Office of Management and Budget, that agency reported that competitive sourcing efforts in 2003 resulted in an average 15% reduction in cost and projected net savings of $1.1 billion over 5 years. Wouldn't it be great if we could do that? Just think how happy the schools would be, the seniors, the veterans, all of our safety officials. In addition, between 1995 and 2000, the Department of Defense completed over 550 competitions, which resulted in an average 34% reduction in cost. Myth number four, competitive sourcing adds to the human capital crunch. The reality? Often government agencies' efforts to move personnel and tap outside experts to realize huge efficiency and effectiveness gains are hamstrung by their own regulatory environment. We often talk about how hamstrung we are because of administrative rulemaking. Incorporating competitive sourcing into the broader context of human capital challenges creates links and improves flexibility, helping solve human capital needs. Agencies could move existing staff between agencies or within the agency to activities considered core or mission critical as needed. Agencies already do have tools that have assisted them with human capital issues in the past and remain promising tools for the future, especially with moving resources and personnel around. My hope would be that the money would also be transferable. By building the human capital management program around agency outcomes and performance, the only thing that counts is performance. In other words, creating the incentives for excellence that make American businesses succeed, agencies could build their internal capabilities around core functions and mission-critical activities. This concentration of effort would allow them to focus their resources on what they do best while shifting resources and activities to contractors to further achieve their goals and objectives. In addition, agencies can focus their competitive sourcing plans around functions where they have difficulty recruiting or where specialized skills are needed. Essentially, the focus becomes one where the agency has the internal capacity to manage service planning rather than actually participating in service delivery. Agencies will have to invest additional resources into contract management and acquisition management personnel to ensure the in-house capabilities exist to be managed. Myth number five, competitive sourcing leads to less flexibility. The reality? Competitive sourcing increases flexibility by enabling agencies to shift resources and focus on core competency. Performance-based contracts get both sides working toward a common goal, improving goods and services. In addition, these contracts do not focus on process, but rather on outcomes, enabling contractors and employees to offer new alternatives to standard delivery to bring more flexibility and innovation. Contracts can be more easily turned on and off than public employees. The competitive bid process also gives managers more flexibility and options. Competitors submit different bids using various techniques and processes to provide the service, giving managers more flexibility. And lastly, myth six. Competitive sourcing leads to layoffs and is unfair to employees. The reality, quite frankly, government employees have been winning competitions at a tremendous rate. Some have argued that the process bias is actually slanted toward government employees, not against them. Of the 662 competitions completed in fiscal year 2003, in-house teams won 89% of competitions. A 1985 GAO study of job displacement as a result of Department of Defense downsizing revealed that of the 9,650 employees affected by privatization, 94% were placed in other government jobs or retired voluntarily. Half of the remaining 6% were employed with a private contractor. Public employees are given a full and fair chance to compete, and when they can demonstrate savings or that they are best equipped to provide a service, they continue to do so. The author of the article that I gave you has had tremendous experience in this area. He holds a master's in public policy from Pepperdine University with specializations in economics and regional local government, and graduated cum laude from good Arizona State with a bachelor's of arts in political science. I hope that that brings to light what I'm hoping to accomplish today. I will give you one good example. In the 1970s, my company bid on a huge job managing aircraft parts for the government. Now, amazing to you, we submitted an alternative proposal that would use the barcode that now is so common. That would have brought about some 25% reduction in costs to the agency we were contracting with. Somehow, because of the bureaucratic system that we were working in, they were unable to approve that alternative for managing a huge parts inventory. And when you consider that the very smallest helicopter has over 12,000 movable parts, you can see what it would be like to manage huge fleets for the government. I often think how much of our taxpayers' money has been lost over these past 20 years because we had an agency that could not quickly move to a new course of process in managing inventories. Also, we provided them an opportunity to participate in what's called a just-in-time inventory, one that gave light when we started UPS in the air and also the USPS and Federal Express on its own. The government could not move with agility. Private enterprise could. I hope you'll pass this bill. In the city of McMinnville, we have an organization called PLAN. Stands for Planned Loving Adoptions Now. I invite you to talk with that agency. They have placed thousands of children into adoptive homes here in America, while our own agency here at the state is wrought with inefficiency and 300 children wait for a home, often for years. I do believe that would be one typical program that would be ripe for competitive sourcing. I appreciate your time, and I will certainly accept any questions, but only those I can answer.
Thank you, Representative. Questions? Representative Shields.
Representative Nelson. I was just curious if you had had any luck in finding Representative Kitts a suitable mate yet.
Yes, I have, and I have the phone number.
Trouble is, she has taste.
Outsourcing.
There you go. I'm not sure the private sector is.
However, I'm not sure all of his other friends are ready for this competitive bidding.
Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I'm curious in this competitive sourcing. Are there any standards that make sure that the competition won't reduce wages and benefits for the people doing this sort of work?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Holby. That can be written into the process.
Thank you.
Representative, there was a mayor, I think it was in Indianapolis, was that made some changes in the way government operates and provides services to their citizens. Is this what he was using? I don't know whether you remember that. There was a book out, I remember.
I remember hearing about that. Unfortunately, I have not read the book.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Sandra Bishop, please.
Good morning. Thank you. Sandra Bishop, representing the Fair Competition Alliance. And I'm here to say that the Fair Competition Alliance is in support of this measure if it goes forward, but only under the condition that it be amended to broaden it out. The Fair Competition Alliance was first formed as a nonprofit trade association in 1998, dealing with a specific statute in Oregon's law which allows nonprofits that employ the disabled to receive contracts without going through the competitive bidding process. And in the ensuing almost a decade now that we've been researching and looking at this issue, what we've found is that there are some basically large corporate nonprofits that have found a way to sequester contracts in such a way that it's having quite a profound impact on local economies in specific geographic areas of the state and also in certain business lines. So what they have done is essentially capture people with disabilities that are not the people with severe disabilities that were intended to be employed by this law originally, but they're actually finding people with disabilities such as wearing glasses or having a transitory medical condition, and they're actually forcing wages down. Over the years, some of the largest unions in the state started joining with the businesses that started the FCA because they're losing family wage jobs, so it's an interesting coalition. So what we would be proposing if the bill goes forward is to amend it to include a review of the current Oregon public purchasing and public contracting processes and policies. Those processes and policies are being codified for the first time through, well, I shouldn't say codified, but they're being put forth in administrative rules. But what the Department of Administrative Services has done over the years is evolve certain ways of purchasing and procurement that no one knows what they're doing. And I want to bring one specific example forward, and that is what's called a VCAF. Vendor Collected Administrative Fee. Last year, the printers who bid on state contracts were told that they would have to pay between 2% and 4% in a, quote, administrative fee through administrative services, through DAS. So it's these kinds of things that really need to be brought out in the open. As legislators, you need to know what your agencies are doing as far as procurement. So we're looking at this as a possible vehicle to be amended to broaden it out. We don't particularly have an interest in competitive sourcing. That terminology usually leads to lower wages and loss of family wage jobs. So we're not looking at outsourcing at all. What we're looking at is using this as an investigation of the total public purchasing and procurement system the state uses. So if it moves forward, we'd like to see that kind of an amendment put in, and would be willing to work with people on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Sandra. Representative Schaffer.
Two questions, please. The fee to the printers, is that currently, are they currently paying that fee?
No, they are not. That was brought up before, I believe it's the House Audits Committee. And once legislators became aware that DAS was proposing that, they said there's no way that we're going to allow the Department of Administrative Services to put forth such a fee. It would have required the fee to be paid by the vendor within 15 days of receiving the contract. And I don't know if you know anything about state contracts, but you certainly don't get payment within 15 days of receiving a contract. So it's a rather bizarre proposal.
And then one more, Mr. Chair, please. Any amendments to the public contracting law that have to do with hiring the disabled, I would like, and I have yet to see anything like this, but some kind of specific, narrowly written definition of disabled. That's what we need to do here. If we ever move on any of this stuff, which I don't think we're gonna. Now, I'm not speaking to representatives, Bill. I'm speaking to public contracting. That's what it's going to take, and we're going to have to get a whole bunch of people to agree on what that definition is before that part of the statute's ever changed. So it better be narrow, better be tight, and better have a whole lot of support. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right. Thank you, Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler. I appreciate that clarity with which you speak on that issue. But what has happened over the years, and the reason that the FCA continues to push for more transparency in the public contracting process that's being used, especially by DAS these days, is that you're faced with a reality that getting a definition of disability, even for the purposes of the products of disabled individuals law, has become impossible because the larger corporate nonprofits have no interest in narrowing a definition when they're sitting on contracts such as a $10 million janitorial contract in Portland. That's a union contract that pays union workers $7 an hour. So it's those kind of things, hurdles they have to get over before they'll agree on a definition. So thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on House Bill 2383? With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2383. And when Janet comes back and tells us, we'll decide what we're going to do. That's probably it then.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Representative Kitts.
I would move the rules be suspended for the possible reconsideration of a vote on House Bill 2392.
Representative Kitts moves the rules be suspended for a possible consideration of a vote on 2392. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the rules are suspended.
Mr. Chair, I would move we amend the previous recommendation by which we had no recommendation to Ways and Means to a due pass of Ways and Means. I misread the fiscal on the bill, which gave me pause. I know Representative Gilman may still decide to not support that at this time, and that's perfectly within his prerogative. However, I think the majority of the committee does support it, so in light of that, I would like to accommodate the majority of the committee, so move to reconsider that vote and amend it to a due pass recommendation from a no recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves to reconsider the vote on 2392. Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, this is just on reconsidering.
Okay.
It's not on the motion to...
You have to take a vote on the reconsideration?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is there any objection?
Oh, I have an objection, of course.
You do have an objection.
Well, I'll go ahead and let you reconsider, but I will let you know that I'll be voting no.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Motion carries. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2392 to the Committee on Ways and Means as amended with a do pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2392 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Shoffler.
Only for the record to say, looks like I pulled my weight on that one.
Nice. Any other discussion? Katie, would call the roll, please.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
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 Aye. Oh, nay.
Almost fell
hurt. I heard it.
No, nay.
He said George Gilman, not John Kerry. Jeez.
Yeah, right. Like that.
Motion carried. In committee, the anticipation will be that it'll be after 10:30 for the caucus is done, and so if there's no objection, I move we adjourn.
Until 10:30.
No, till for the day, and then we are adjourned.